Lisa Davis. Welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM. April is Autism Awareness Month, and joining us today is Ellen Nottbaum. She is the author, along with Veronica Zisk, of 1001 Great Ideas for Teaching and Raising Children with Asperger's or Autism or Asperger's. It is a fantastic book, and Ellen Nottbaum is a three-time Forward Book of the Year finalist. Ellen Nottbaum is author of one of the autism community's most beloved books, 10 Things Every Child with Autism Wishes She Knew. She is also author of 10 Things Your Student with Autism Wishes You Knew and the Eric Hoffer Book Award finalist, The Autism Trail Guide, Postcards from the Road Less Traveled. Her articles, commentary, and book excerpts have appeared in hundreds of magazines, newspapers, academic journals, training manuals, and websites around the world. Ellen welcomes reader feedback and newsletter signups through her website at ellennottbaum.com, ellennottbaum.com. And her co-author, Veronica Ziss, has been working in the field of autism since 1991. She has served as executive director of the Autism Society of America from 1991 to 1996, and then joined Future Horizons, moving into an editorial position within the company in 1999 as managing editor and visionary for the first national magazine on autism spectrum disorders, the Autism Asperger's Digest, winner of multiple gold awards for excellence. Ellen, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM.
Thank you, Lisa. I'm happy to be here.
I'm very happy to have you here. Now, in the foreword to your fantastic book, 1001 Great Ideas for Teaching and Raising Children with Autism or Asperger's, Temple Grandin writes, quote, "During my childhood years, my mother and teachers utilized many of the methods discussed in this excellent book. They recognized that when it came to teaching a child with autism, creativity, patience, and understanding, as well as strategies that made sense to me, were the key to helping me become the independent, successful person I am today." And I want to say, Ellen, that your book is truly remarkable, and the ideas in it are so effective. That's why I'm so glad to have you here today. And if you can tell us a little bit how you got involved in this field.
In the field of autism?
Yes.
Okay. Well, as many people do, I did it because it touched my family. My son was identified with autism at age 3, and at that time we entered the world of therapies and special preschool, special education, and I came in contact with a lot of wonderful people, one of whom encouraged me to write my experiences because she felt that my son was not the typical child with autism and I was not the typical parent of a child with autism. At the time, I laughed her off, but I later met Veronica, and one conversation led to another, and we ended up writing what became the first edition of the book that we're talking about today, which has been a bestseller practically since the day of publication, and that was 5 years ago, so it was time to update and expand some of those ideas.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm not at all surprised that it's a bestseller now. In the preface, you write that the values and beliefs you and your co-author, Veronica Zisk, share are distilled down to three elements. What are those three elements?
Three elements. Yes, we are staunch believers in sensory integration therapy, and that the disorders to the sensory system that are common in children with autism are the basis for addressing behavior, communication, and cognitive problems. So first of all, sensory intervention. And equally important, the language and communication issues that are so often characteristic of autism. On anybody's baseline in anybody's life, but magnified for these children, is the fact that if you do not have a functional means of communication, your wants and needs are going to go unmet. When I speak to audiences, I frequently ask them to visualize an exercise wherein they go to work each day or even for one day with mm-hmm. their mouth taped shut. And how does that affect your ability to communicate and your ability to fulfill expectations and your ability to interact with coworkers? And as your frustration builds throughout the day, you know, at the end of the day, you're likely to see something we call behavior. And that's all communication-based. So those are the first two things. And number three, which probably should be number one, is the fact that it is incumbent upon us as adults to view a child with autism as a whole child and not a baggie of broken pieces or a fix-it project, and that providing them with our unconditional love and acceptance of them as a whole person is the foundation for building everything else they need to learn and do.
The book's divided into six different sections, and you mentioned one of the elements was sensory integration. Can you define that for people who might not be clear?
Right, and this was the single most difficult thing for me to get my head around when my son was identified with autism, and it's something that a lot of us don't think about because our brains perform sensory integration naturally without us having to think about it. Sensory integration is the way in which the brain manages all the sensory information that's coming at us at any one time. Most people can name five senses that they think of right off the bat: vision, touch, taste, hearing, smell. May not be aware that there are as many as 21 different senses at work in the body at any one time. Our vestibular sense governs balance. There's the sense that perceives pain, the sense that perceives temperature, the sense that perceives changes in where your body moves in space. We call that a proprioceptive sense, and that all of these modalities are working at once. And for the child with autism, there is frequently what I refer to as a traffic jam in the brainstem. The brain with autism cannot filter that many inputs at once, and consequently, it is easy for the child to become overwhelmed with sensory input, and we frequently see that in the behaviors that we find so cryptical and sometimes quote-unquote negative are frequently reactions to the brain's inability to process that kind of sensory input.
Yeah, and that's really hard to explain to people. You know, my daughter, she gets easily overstimulated, and I try to explain, and I tell people what they should do is they should watch the movie called Temple Grandin. I don't know if you've seen it with Claire Danes.
It's an HBO movie. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it is so fantastic. And there's a scene where she's in the cafeteria, and every little sound, the chopping of the carrots, the clanging of the silverware, the plates, the putting food on it, the people talking in the background, it's just too much. And I wish I had that on, like, a little TV in my hand. I could say, this is what it's like, because I thought they captured it so well.
My elementary school that I attended more than 40 years ago has instigated a Disabilities Awareness Day where they simulate many different disabilities for children, and what they do for to simulate the sensory difficulties of a child with autism is they put the kids in a desk, they turn a fan on them, they play a radio behind them, they tickle their neck with a feather, you know, really kind of trying to simulate what overstimulation feels like.
That is brilliant.
Yeah.
Wow, that would be great to be in many schools. Now, you know, you mentioned earlier about behavior, and in the book you write, behavior is communication. We repeat, behavior is communication. And that's something that I think people need to understand. When you said earlier, if your mouth was taped, if you imagine that, and you're feeling strongly about something, the way you behave is the way people are going to be able to tell what's going on, and that's the same thing that happens with children with autism. So if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yes, behavior is communication. Everything your child does, as well as everything he says, is telling you something about the way he reacts to his environment. And what Veronica and I kind of distill it down to is an equation. And the equation is you plus me plus environment equals behavior. So there are not only the sensory components that we've talked briefly about, and the communication components play into that as well. There are other factors, physical and temporal elements that play in, but one of the biggest that we discuss at length in the book is, as an adult, your own behavior will reflect on your child, and his behavior will be a response to your own. And this is a hard thing for a lot of parents to get and teachers to get their arms around, the fact that how you respond to him is going to affect how he responds to you. And so often, without realizing it, there are so many things that we do that feed into the very behaviors that we're trying to extinguish. And, of course, extinguishing a behavior completely ignores the fact that the behavior has an underlying reason. Every behavior has a root cause, and without identifying the root cause, you'll never be able to address the need. So there's this big circular equation going on.
And that brings us back to the section you have on communication and language. And, you know, there's a lot of challenges in that area. And what are some tips and some advice? Because, again, if the communication is better, it's going to make things easier for everybody.
Well, the most important thing to remember is that a child with autism needs a functional means of communication in whatever form that may take. And his functional form of communication may not be the same as yours. But as the adult in the equation, it's incumbent upon us as adults to find out what that functional inroad is. Some children will have very limited verbal skills and will communicate better through visual means. Some will require a combination of both. But what needs to happen first is to identify the challenges that are creating the communication difficulties. For many children with autism, it will be the fact that they are concrete thinkers. And when we say concrete thinkers, what we mean is they think in very black and white terms, whereas we as a society tend to talk in idioms,
mm-hmm.
metaphors, slang, sarcasm, and just plain old sloppy talk, you know, like, I mean, and it's almost indecipherable for these kids. So just the awareness that we have to bring our language down to a concrete level where we're saying exactly what we mean and speaking to them directly, not hands and eyes flying around the room, that sort of thing, which reduces it to a real concrete level. That's the first step. Then when you start layering on top of that all of the expectations for social communication that we have, you're talking about a real complicated package of
mm-hmm.
social skills, all related to how we communicate with each other, not just with words, but with our body language, with our facial expression, with the distance that we keep from each other when we're talking, which is different for each relationship, and the cultural expectations that are laid on top of that. So communication gets to be a very, very complicated, multi-layered proposition that we need to break down into its stellar components in order to have a place to start.
Well, that's why your book is so important, to definitely check it out. Now, you mentioned a moment ago about the social aspects, and you write in the book that children with autism and Asperger's, it's like they're born without a social navigation system. And we just have a few minutes left, but if you
mm-hmm.
can just touch on that.
Well, yeah, although I'm tempted to not touch on such a huge subject in only a few minutes. But it kind of goes back to what I said earlier about the manner in which we relate to each other is something that most children, typically developing children, will kind of observe and gain as they go through life. The idea of joint referencing, where you look to another person for a response and have a shared experience, the idea of initiating a conversation, letting the other person know that you're interested in them, being able to sustain the back and forth, being able to read a person's facial expression and determine whether a particular response is appropriate or inappropriate, you know, just those things that make us social.
Mm-hmm.
That little piece is missing from the brain with autism. Will it be missing forever? No. Can these things be taught? Yes. Does it take a long time? Yes. It's something that, like anything else we teach, is taught in increments. Bite-sized increments. And what's wonderful for all of us today is that in many classrooms around the country now, I'm starting to see what they call social-emotional curriculum. That is the teaching of these types of skills along with the cognitive intelligence skills. So we're seeing an importance addressed or assigned to it, not just for the child with autism, but for all children, with the understanding, of course, that our kids are going to need a more intensive education in this area, but nevertheless is being recognized as something necessary in healthy development.
It's so great right now, all the good things that are going on. And, you know, speaking of schools and teachers, the last section is teachers and learners. And Veronica, your co-author, writes that you were recently asked a question by a reporter, quote, what is the single most important thing parents need to know about special education? What did you say?
Actually, I think was that the question? I thought it was, what is the single most important thing parents need to know, which was a question, just broad spectrum that you can hardly even begin to answer. But my answer was, the single most important thing parents and teachers can do is to have a productive, dynamic relationship on behalf of the child. And what that means is you go into a relationship beginning with a clean slate. You each leave your preconceived notions about schools and kids with autism and all of that behind and come together as professionals who each have an assigned job for the betterment of the child. There's a eager and willing give and take, exchange of information, goal planning, and a general productive, creative partnership that leaves personalities at the door and that doesn't set up the adversarial type relationships that we so often see between schools and parents. With that kind of relationship, children will accomplish to their fullest potential. Without it, I don't believe anything productive can happen.
You know, and speaking of having children, you know, function at the best level, you know, the section four in your book, which I want to just mention, is on daily living. And you say, quote, teaching our children functional life skills requires long, patient, hands-on repetition and reinforcement. And this goes back to what Temple talked about in the foreword and during a recent interview I did with her. And I think that's really important because I read sometimes where it says, you know, people forget that children with autism are going to grow up to be adults with autism.
Right. That's
and
right.
They're going to need to function in the world and have the skills. And I think it's great that you focus on that. And again, your book is just so, it's such a wonderful resource. And I know this is going to help so many people. I have a lot of listeners that have children on the spectrum or with sensory processing disorder or other issues that this is so helpful for. And, you know, I interviewed Eustacia Cutler recently, Temple Grandin's mother, actually twice, and just hearing about what it was like for her, you know, in the 1950s when your child got diagnosed with autism, they called it infant schizophrenia. And look how far we've come.
And how much farther we will go
yes.
in the next, yep.
Yeah, but it's nice to see at least a bit of progress.
well, Temple is, you know, she's always, in all of her books, she strongly emphasizes that children do become adults. And so there is a large part of our book that is devoted to encouraging independence in the child. And one part, I believe it's in the daily living part, we go through and say, this is how you encourage independence in a toddler. This is how you do it in the young child, the older child, and the reluctant child. So seeing my son at 17 being almost completely independent as he is now has been a remarkable journey. And to see them come to that point where he practically takes care of me, it can happen.
Oh, that is so wonderful. Well, I want to thank you so much. And tell us again your website.
www.ellennotbohm.com. It's ELLENNOTBOHM.
People want to reach me, they can go to itsyourhealthradio.org.